It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one-stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you. This is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. We've got two Skype guests for you this week. We're going to talk to Chuck Dixon again. Chuck put out an article in the Wall Street Journal this week, and it's gotten a lot of controversies. A lot of people online, for and against. Chuck's a good friend of ours. He's been on the show before, so I wanted to talk to him and get his take on it. It's a great conversation. But before that, we've got Ted Alexandro. Ted's a New York comic. He's been a New York comic for 20 years. He's a great guy. He's been on Conan. He's been on Letterman. He's been on Jimmy Kimmel. He released his one-hour special, I Did It, on his website, tedalexandro.com, a few months ago. And as we were talking about getting him on to talk about that, he also started a Kickstarter for a new web series called Teacher's Lounge, and it looks fantastic. There is a commercial for it online. It's on the Facebook page for Caffeinated Comics right now, but it is a series that he developed that is guest starring Janine Garofalo, Jim Gaffigan, Dave Attell, Lewis Black, Mark Normand, Bill Burr, more huge, huge names. It looks fantastic, but he has to start a Kickstarter. He needs some funds to get it finished and running and on computers. So we're going to talk to him first. It's another great conversation, and then we will go to Chuck Dixon.
This was kind of my year of kind of jumping back into the fray as far as putting out some things that that I've been working on. So my hour special, I Did It, was the first thing. And now I'm kind of ramping up to releasing a web series that I've been working on for a long time called Teacher's Lounge.
Yeah, how long have you been working on it?
You know, it's tough to say because it feels like forever. I started in comedy as part of a duo with my friend from college named Hollis James. And Hollis and I went to Queens College together, and he had started up a sketch comedy group there. And I auditioned for that in college and got into the sketch group, submitted some sketches that I had written, and that kind of changed the course of my life. You know, getting into that sketch group and, you know, the things that I had written, being approved for the show and performing, you know, on stage as part of this group. And then later after graduation, Hollis and I started going out to New York City open mics together as a duo. So that was really kind of what planted the seed for me to even kind of, you know, start a career in comedy. So we did that kind of for a couple of years on and off.
So how did you work? Now I've only seen you really do stand up on your own. How did you guys work as a duo? Because were you guys like straight man, funny guy? Did you split jokes up? Did you interact on stage? Because there's a bunch of different ways to do it.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I don't think we had really figured all of that out. We were so green and right out of college. We didn't have like a set kind of formula of, you know, straight man, silly guy. It was more almost like we were acting out sketches. We would introduce, you know, one sketch to the next.
Okay.
And, you know, we were doing pretty well. We passed an audition at like the comic strip in New York, which was kind of a big deal at the time. And, you know, we had some minor successes, but it just got too much, I think, to do the duo thing, and we had different interests, and I was kind of wanting to start the solo thing. So anyway, that was kind of the background of our friendship. But we always kind of stayed in touch, and we did a number of creative projects together over the years. We did a mockumentary about the first integrated ventriloquist team, where I play a ventriloquist and I work with a black dummy. And no one would hire us. It's set during the civil rights movement. No one would book us because we were interracial. So we did like a fake documentary about that. And we did some, you know, some musical parodies. This song called "Kiss Our American Ass" about when Bin Laden got killed.
Yeah, I saw that. I remember that. You got a giant mustache.
That's right. That's right. The mustache did most of the work.
Yeah, that's the first thing I remember. There was a mustache. Then there was some singing.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So that's kind of the background to, you know, Hollis and I have been working together for 20 years. about 8 years ago, we had the idea for Teacher's Lounge because I used to be an elementary school music teacher here in New York. And
what neighborhood? Was it close to Astoria?
Yeah, yeah. I taught at two different schools in Bayside, Queens.
Okay.
So, you know, not too far from where I grew up and not too far from where I live now in Astoria. But anyway, yeah, I was teaching for about 5 years. And yeah, we just had this idea. It was kind of a simple concept that we thought would be an evergreen. It was I would be the music teacher. Hollis would play the janitor at a school. And we're always just hanging out in the teacher's lounge. And then we'd invite other comedians on to play guest faculty members. So that was the idea. And, you know, we pitched it around. We wrote a pilot. It went through many different iterations until finally we said, you know what, let's just shoot this ourselves, man. Like, I've got the contacts. I've got a little money together. Why don't we just, you know, I'll put my money into it. I'll call in, you know, with all the people that I have relationships with over these many years. So that's what we did. And we shot 10 episodes. We just finished shooting. And we got people like Jim Gaffigan as the earth science teacher, Lewis Black as the principal, Judy Gold as the gym teacher, Janine Garofalo is the public address announcer, Judah Friedlander is the computer science teacher, Todd Barry is the librarian. David Tell is the school photographer. You know, on and on. We just got so many great people. Yeah, so it's now it's like it's almost surreal that we actually did it and shot it. So now we're doing a Kickstarter to try to raise money just to kind of finish the editing and the post-production work. You know, because it's all being done independently, and I would like to, you know, pay the crew and a lot of people who volunteered and all that kind of stuff. So that's where we're at with Teacher's Lounge right now. But it's pretty exciting to finally see it coming together.
Yeah, how long are the episodes? Are they full 20 minutes? Or are they more like digital shorts?
Yeah, these are digital shorts for the, you know, it's a web series. So they're all in the neighborhood of about 5 minutes. I'd say 4 or 5 minutes each of them. Some of them, you know, we might do longer. Others we might just, you know, we might do things where we show outtakes too because there's so much good stuff. The way it's written is, Hollis and I write them, and then we leave room for improvisation, and that's usually where there's so many great things that, you know, because these comics are all so great, it's fun to watch what they come up with, you know, so that's usually, we'll give them some bullet points of basic ideas, so it's a combination of scripted and improvised.
Well, and so when these are finished, are you thinking of a YouTube channel, or are you building your own website for it? What's the ultimate home?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of in the process of being shopped around, and we're hoping that it'll land somewhere. There's a couple of, you know, possibilities, but that's kind of still being worked out. But it will be on the web, and it's just a matter of where it's going to land. But we're excited about seeing where that happens, and it'll be this summer. It's coming up soon.
Oh, cool. So in some ways, you shot a first season as a pilot. Because, as you said, you could still land it somewhere.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that was the idea. It was like, you know, again, after this 8-year process of the winding road of pitching things and taking meetings, actually writing a pilot script, it just came back to, and this is very much how I like to operate anyway, it came back to the basic thought of, like, well, why don't we just do this, man? Why don't we, you know, write the scripts for the web, invite my comedian friends to come on and shoot it ourselves, you know, and then whatever it turns out to be, at least it'll be our vision. And, you know, we can do it without kind of having to compromise anything on this end. And then it'll live and breathe as it is. And then, you know, we can take it from there. So in the end, you know, although it was like a long process, as often happens, I think it was for the best because now we have something that we're really excited about.
Yeah, where did you shoot it? Did you find a location?
You know, Jim Gaffigan actually, because he has so many kids, he recommended a school. It's called, what is it called? St. Patrick's Old Cathedral down on Mott and Prince Street in New York.
They actually called it the Old Cathedral?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not a modern McMansion cathedral like you see today.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, this is the real deal, you know. So it's like this, it's this old school that's no longer in use, but now they rent out the school from time to time for shoots or for events and what have you. So Jim knew about it, and he put in a word for us, so we were able to get it at a bit of a discount. But it's a really great looking, it's an authentic kind of school room, you know, and we dressed it up to look like a teacher's lounge. But we got lucky with that because it's in the city, so that everyone could get there. And it's a perfect space for a teacher's lounge.
That's awesome. Now, with the school, did you have full run of the school, or did you guys keep it contained to the one room of the lounge?
Yeah, you know, we had room to kind of take some B-roll stuff around the rest of the school. Mm-hmm. But as far as the show, we keep it in the teacher's lounge. So each of the episodes more or less takes place in that room. You know, if this does eventually become a series, then we'd love to kind of, you know, obviously take it outside of the lounge. But for these, everything takes place in the teacher's lounge.
Right, which can give you that freedom of having tight parameters anyway.
Yeah, no, I think it's good because, you know, the basic formula is you know, Hollis and I are at the table, and there's some stuff, you know, there's some kind of almost like Seinfeld at the diner, you know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's kind of what grounds it is our friendship and our relationship. Then these, you know, these guest comedians come in, and there's always some great stuff. You know, they're kind of the hub of, you know, what goes on in each episode. And then Janine Garofalo is the public address announcer. She begins each episode actually with a public address announcement, you know, something kind of weird or out there, or, you know, so it's just, we feel like we have like some really good components.
She in voiceover or is she there?
Yeah, she's in voiceover. Yep. Cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, as we said, this is the second thing you've done.
Yeah.
Online, how did the special go? How did that live up to expectations? I saw it and I loved it. But did it? How was it once you launched it? What did you learn from putting it online?
The special was great. You know, it was another kind of experience where, you know, I kind of came back to my core of doing things DIY, for better or for worse. You know, that seems to be the road that I like to go, because I think I like to make decisions and I like to be involved. I don't like to hand over my creations, you know, unless it's a good partnership or it's someone who's really backing it both financially and creatively in a way that I'm comfortable with. So for this special and the way that I wanted to do it, it really just kind of turned out that shooting it independently and releasing it online using a pay what you want model felt right to me. It felt like the right time and the right way to do it. And it turned out to be that it generated a lot of good buzz. I made back all the money and then some.
That's awesome.
Which felt good. Yeah. I was taking a risk, you know, on that side of things. So, you know, it was another good learning process. You know, it's harder to do things independently, and it's harder to have to make all those decisions. It's a lot easier to just show up the day of the shooting and do your performance and then hand it over to whoever and then, you know, watch it when it comes out. But I was involved in every step of the process, and I like that, you know, and the people that I admire do that, whether it's Louis C.K. or, you know, any number of people who have built their career that way. I kind of realized a few years ago that, you know, I want to be in the business of like creating things and being involved in the process. I don't want to just be a cog who, you know, I don't want to just be an actor. I don't want to just be a comedian. I want to be somebody who makes things and sees things through from start to finish. So I think that's a skill set that I've been developing these last few years, and it's been gratifying.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's great that the internet allows that to happen in a way where it used to be, I'm sure you know better than I do, where 20 years ago you just got hope to be picked up by the machine and plugged in.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the most you could do is VHS tape.
Right, right.
But yeah, the creek I noticed was multiple camera. The thing I loved about it was it felt really real. The fact that you used the creek, which is a small room to begin with.
Yes.
And it's a room I know well, but it felt like, you know, there's maybe 30, 40 people in the room. It felt like that's what a real New York set is. It's not like an HBO One Night Stand or a Premium Blend kind of thing.
And I
love that. I love that you had – and you gave yourself the hour to stretch out. And that's – it's what an hour in New York actually feels like, which I've never seen in a special.
Thanks. Yeah, yeah. That's kind of what I had in mind, you know. I wanted to strip down – a lot of the bells and whistles and kind of airbrushing that goes on with these specials where it's like a big packed theater with sweeping shots of the crowd and, you know, a frenzied kind of crowd that knows they're on television. You know, my crowd didn't even know I was taping my special. I didn't announce it as such. I taped like several nights over a week. It was four nights and we wound up using the Saturday night as kind of the hub and then just a few elements from other nights, edited in. But, you know, people didn't know that they were there for the taping of a special. I really just wanted to do exactly what you said, which is to capture a set, in a small room and also have the vulnerability of, you know, I'm not killing like every moment. The material is, you know, the performance is what it is. And I wanted that as well. Because I didn't want this. I think a lot of the specials have this invulnerability, which is kind of antithetical to what stand-up really is. Like, there has to be vulnerability. There has to be an element of, you know, I don't know if this is going to work. And I don't want to know that I'm going to kill. I just want to do my performance and kind of see what happens. And so I'm proud of what that special is because I think it's a true stand-up performance.
Yeah, awesome. Now with Teacher's Lounge, now that you've shot it, as you said, you've been thinking about it for 8 years, doing it in different formats, and then having other comics come in and riff and improv off of the finished script. Was there anything that really surprised you? Was there anything that came out really differently than you thought?
Oh yeah. A lot of things. I mean, you know, we have a thing where Judy Gold plays the gym teacher and she talks about like how she spent her summer vacation. And she went on this riff about like spending her summer at a nudist colony with her family. And, you know, she just took it into all these great places, you know. So, like, we would just give, again, you know, we'd give people bullet points. You know, Ted Leo, the musician, we have him coming to play a concert for the kids. And, you know, we kind of just gave him some things talking about playing children's music and why he decided to follow that career path, all of which is not true, of course. I mean, he doesn't play children's concerts, but like for the show he did. And he came up, I mean, that was what was really fun too, is because I know Ted through like some mutual friends and through the comedy scene, since he kind of overlaps and does a lot of comedy stuff and used to be on Best Show with Tom Sharpling on WFUV. So Ted was fantastic and really everyone. I mean, the beauty of it is these people come in and we watch them and you see them from take to take, like building and getting their feet. And then, you know, by the fourth, fifth take, they're just like Jim Norton is another one. He was the head of security. And he was amazing talking about keeping the school safe and the things that keep him up at night. And, you know, it was so much fun. I mean, everyone, Jim Gaffigan, Rachel Feinstein, Michael Che, you know, there's so many talented people and everybody uniquely brings, you know, their comedic sensibility. So that's what's fun about it.
Oh, that's amazing. And as you said, you like to keep active and you like to stay involved. I think that's another big side of you because I know you're very involved with Occupy Wall Street and you're creating a performance space in Astoria.
Yeah, it's like a community space. There will be performance aspects to it, but it's more of a community space, community center, library, arts, that whole type of thing. Yeah. The way that came about was, as you say, I was involved with Occupy Wall Street, which then we had kind of an offshoot spring up here. We started Occupy Astoria in my neighborhood, Astoria, Long Island City. And, you know, that basically started because some of my neighbors that I had never met here in Astoria, I met in Zuccotti Park, of all places. So it was this bizarre realization that, you know, there's people right in my neighborhood that I'm not meeting who are like-minded and kind of, you know, wanting to be engaged and wanting to talk about issues and whatnot.
That's, you know, that's one of the things I always loved about Astoria. I moved there in my 20s, and then mm-hmm. I was there for a long time. But I kept running into people outside that would turn out were like three blocks away.
Yes.
It's this amazingly dense neighborhood of, like, of culture. But all different cultures.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. And it is crazy that, you know, there could be people living in the apartment next to me that I don't say anything but hello to, but then, you know, you can meet them in another context. And that's kind of what happened with Occupy Astoria. Like, we decided after meeting these folks, we said, well, let's start up our own kind of local community group. And, we put up some posters around town, and we had 25 people show up to the first meeting at a cafe locally. And from there, it just kept growing. And now we have, like, I think over 300 people on our Facebook page. And that's kind of grown into, like, now this community space, which will be, you know, it'll be somewhat political and activist in nature, but it'll also be just a community space for the people that live in the neighborhood.
So more of a grassroots than a
absolutely.
A headline grabbing movement.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, the cool thing for me is, like, I'm one of, you know, just people that come through the door and pick up a hammer and a paintbrush, and mm-hmm. everybody contributes in whatever way they can. So it's nice to be part of that.
Yeah. So basically, what you're saying is you can't sit still.
You know, I scratch my head. Sometimes I really would like to. And I guess, like a lot of people, I do fantasize about, like, going to, like, a cabin in the woods and just living a very Spartan, quiet existence. But I guess that's not really in the cards for now, because, like you say, I just keep doing something.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't recommend it. I ended up moving out to the suburbs, and I'm ready to pull my hair out some days.
Right.
Like, yeah. I have to get in a car to go everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess the grass is greener, but
yeah,
yeah. No, but I did think to myself the other day, as busy as I am and as crazy as it's been, I'm really very happy and proud of the things that I've been able to put my time into and achieve these last, you know, several months, because it's all things that I really love and care about. And it's been, you know, it's really nice to see it all coming together. It all happens, like, at such a whirlwind pace that sometimes you don't really appreciate it. But yeah, it's been nice to see all of these various things coming together.
Yeah. And as you said, it's all been on your own terms lately.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And, you know, even like the Kickstarter that we're doing for Teachers Lounge, you know, we did a video for that, Hollis and I. And I called in some friends like Amy Schumer, Russell Peters, Bill Burr, Jim Gaffigan, Dave Attell. They're in the Kickstarter video. They helped us out to kind of get the word out. And, you know, on top of all the people who appear in the Teachers Lounge series. So the Kickstarter has been doing well. We're at about the halfway point, and we're at about halfway in terms of what we're looking to raise. So,
right. So, what's the deadline on this? Because this episode will go out a couple of days from now.
The deadline is June 26th. So we've got about 2 weeks remaining on that. So yeah, man, we're just, you know, trying to get the word out. We're looking to raise $50,000, which is actually less than it cost me to make. But, you know, we're just trying to, again, pay everybody who, a lot of who donated their time and stuff like that. And just, you know, get this thing through post-production and get it finished and get it out this summer. So people have really been great, and really a lot of people have been donating and sending great messages. And, you know, everybody who sees the video or hears about the series has been so positive in their feedback. So it's been really great, you know. So we're just trying to keep that momentum going through the 26th.
Yeah, and that's it. This is interesting. You're one of the first Kickstarters I've heard of where the content's already been produced, where it's not like I have an idea and I have a pitch. You've already done this. You're trying to make back some of the money and then polish it the best way possible.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like it was like we were shooting we started shooting after the launch of the Kickstarter. So like it was kind of in progress. But we knew in order to finish it that, I mean, that we just kind of wanted to engage people, both in terms of like allowing people to pitch in to see the thing through, but also hopefully that people would be excited about it, want to contribute, and also get the word out about the series. So it kind of served a dual purpose. But the main purpose being that we do need, you know, we need help.
And how can we find the Kickstarter?
The Kickstarter can be found through tedalexandro.com. It's also on my Twitter at tedalexandro and Facebook. Yeah, I mean, if you search Ted Alexandro Teachers Lounge Kickstarter, you'll find it. But it's on the homepage of my website.
Yeah, and the special is on the website as well, isn't it?
Yes, the special is called I Did It, and it's an hour and I think 5 or 6 minutes. Pay what you want. I think the lowest you can pay is 99 cents because that was what the company that I went through, that was the lowest that you could do, I guess, just in terms of charging credit cards. Mm-hmm. So anything up from 99 cents is what you can pay for the special. And that was – again, like something that I was inspired by mainly Louis C.K., but, you know, even guys like Jim Gaffigan or Aziz, Bill Burr, people who had put out their own special.
I didn't realize Aziz had done it. I've seen Bill Burr's and I've seen Gaffigan's and Louis.
Yeah, I think Aziz put out his last special the same way for $5. So, you know, after seeing those guys, I kind of thought, well, why don't I give that a try, but just maybe go the step further of allowing people to pay what they want for the special. And that turned out really good because, in fact, you know, people wound up paying more than the $5 on average, which was fascinating because so many people said to me, aren't you worried that people are going to just pay a buck or whatever? And some people did, but I figured, you know, those are the people who might not pick it up anyway. You know, maybe people will take a chance on it that don't know you or, you know, they're not necessarily fans. So I think it worked well because my fans, you know, or people who know my work, they paid, you know, whatever they felt was it was worth. And then people just tried it out for a buck or whatever.
Yeah. And now what's going on with stand-up? I know you did Conan recently. Are you on the road right now? Are you mostly in New York?
For the summer, I'm mostly in New York. But I'm actually in the planning stages for the fall going into the winter of putting together a road tour because with everything that's been going on, I've been so focused on Teacher's Lounge and having just put out the special that, you know, I've kind of been in New York and I'll be here in New York primarily through the summer, but then I'll start touring in the fall and winter.
And what are you going to be doing some of the material on I Did It or do you feel that's retired now that it's recorded and you're building up a new set?
A combination of the two, you know, because there's some stuff on I Did It that was really like brand new for the special, you know, stuff that kind of came around really in the month or even weeks prior to the special, some of it even that night. I mean, I kind of allow myself to be fluid with that. But when I tour, I primarily try to retire stuff that I feel is older. So it'll be a mix and an ongoing mix towards eventually eliminating everything that's on the special for a new special.
No, it's great. Yeah. Well, when you come back to the Midwest, we'll have to hook up again.
For sure, man. Absolutely. But,
yeah, congratulations on Teacher's Lounge. I mean, I think it's at a place where you can have congratulations.
Yes.
And good luck on the Kickstarter. We'll let everybody know every way we can.
Thank you so much, John. I appreciate that.
You can find the links to I Did It and Teacher's Lounge at tedalexander.com. We've also posted them on the Caffeinated Comics Facebook page. So, as you heard, Ted Alexander is pretty hard left. He was a centerpiece of Occupy Wall Street. So let's switch to hard right and talk to Chuck Dixon. This week, the Wall Street Journal ran an article titled How Liberalism Became Kryptonite for Superman, written by Chuck Dixon. It's something that set off a controversy in the blogosphere and in the internet. But as I read it, I was surprised to read how even-handed it was. It reminded me of what political discourse used to be in the days before Fox News and before the right versus left became so combative. I agreed with some of the points in it, and I don't consider myself conservative. And when I talked to Chuck, I agreed with him even more. I don't know if he persuaded me, but I certainly didn't feel antagonistic about this article at all, which why I wanted him on the show, because a lot of the response on the internet have been pretty combative, as the internet tends to get. You can read How Liberalism Became Kryptonite for Superman on the Wall Street Journal online, and we have also placed that on the Caffeinated Comics Facebook page. So if you want to do your research before this conversation, hit pause. Go to Facebook, like us, read the article, and then come back and we'll listen to Chuck Dixon. One word of note, Chuck's Wi-Fi was going in and out, so we could have talked for 2 hours and that would have been the whole episode. But unfortunately, we were only able to speak for about 40 minutes, so you'll hear the whole conversation here. And in a way, it's good because it allowed us to have time to talk to Ted. But also, we kind of cover it pretty well in this conversation.
Cool. So, Chuck, today the internet is focused on you, and they're all talking about the same thing. Why the Hawaiian shirts?
I love them. I've worn Hawaiian shirts since before they were cool, if they ever were cool.
I don't know if they ever were cool.
No, I don't think so. You know, it's funny. The last MegaCon, I'm not going to wear a Hawaiian shirt because I'm tired of people asking me if I'm George Perez. So I wore black polo shirts all 3 days. And a number of times people came up and asked me if I was Alex Saviuk. And I had forgotten that that's Alex's uniform, the black polo shirt. So
do you think people come up to George Perez asking if he's Chuck Dixon?
He told me that it has happened.
Okay. So that feels good. At least you know the pecking order is equal.
There you go.
But your Wall Street Journal article came out.
Yes.
And it's been let's start at the beginning. What inspired this and your co-writer did the Wall Street Journal approach you? Did you have this kind of as an idea and looked for a place to put it?
Well, Paul and I worked together on The Forgotten Man. It's an adaptation of Amity Schlaes's History of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And my involvement with it ended years ago. Paul's been trolling it all this time. But we stay in contact. And when the assignment first came up, I was the first guy in, you know, and I talked to Amity and her publishers and her people. And my first and only choice was Paul Revoche. And the weird thing is, I just thought he was perfect for the material, and he could just draw the hell out of it. And he's so versatile, and he draws awesome hats. He does great period detail, and I thought, well, he'll get into it. I had no idea of his politics, and when I approached him, I found out that he was very simpatico with this book and the way the Great Depression was being portrayed, and the way that the story was being retold. With a lot of information that most Americans weren't aware of. It isn't the Great Depression that we've all been taught. It's the Great Depression that really happened and all these great characters. So Paul agreed to do it. Over the time, you know, he and I have talked about comics and politics and all the rest of it. And with the Forgotten Man graphic novel out now, Amity thought, well, this would be a good time to have a discussion about politics in comics as they are now in the postmodern era of comics. And she helped arrange for Paul and I to have this piece put in the Wall Street Journal. And it all went very quickly. It seemed to start last Friday, and then all of a sudden, kaboom, we're in there on Monday.
Yeah.
But that's the newspaper business, I guess. So that's how that all happened.
Yeah, so and it seemed like the reaction was immediate. I was following you on Facebook today, and it seemed like you got a lot of support and the opposite of support from some quarters. How do you feel? Were you expecting it to people to react this way, or
I knew it would blow up. My wife went on the internet cruising for commentary, and I said, no, don't, please don't do that.
It'll come to you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with the Facebook because they pretty much have to talk to me, you know, mm-hmm. so they're going to moderate themselves somewhat. And I think I parted friends with most of the people who disagree with me. I mean, you know, the certain kind of strangers that are your friends on Facebook.
Right.
I don't think I made anybody mad. I had some fun and they had some fun, but it stayed pretty civilized. Now I know out in the wilderness of the internet, I'm being pilloried, and you know, the villagers are there with the torches and pitchforks, but I stand by what I wrote.
Yeah. Well, I read it this morning and I thought you made some really interesting points. The one thing I liked in this political climate that I thought it was reasoned and well thought out and wasn't based on attacking the people who disagreed with you, which you don't see much of anymore.
No, I mean, I have no interest in making people mad. I mean, I have an interest in broadening the base for comic book readership, and that's my objection to a lot of the things that have been done with the superheroes. And the article was all about superhero comics. It wasn't about graphic novels in particular or all kinds of different comics. You know, we're not trying to turn the clock back to 1955. It's just for superhero comics, you know, hey, how about some all-ages, middle-of-the-road superhero comics in which the superheroes are heroes first and foremost? And, you know, that's all we were talking about, that the comics are shrinking their base by appealing, you know, by making them political at all. I mean, if they were all conservative or all left wing, it's going to turn off half your potential readership. It's not the point of the comics. They're broad based, escapist, lowbrow entertainment superheroes. It's invincible guys with superpowers beating up bad guys. I mean, you can make it more sophisticated than that, certainly, but you don't have to make it so mature or so opinionated or so agenda driven that it turns off the readership.
Yeah, well, I agree in that respect. I feel that there are some characters that can take levels of sophistication, and some characters you lose something. I think Superman's the perfect example. That it seems like DC's had a very, very hard time selling Superman by trying to make him these shades of gray. It seems like it doesn't fit the character as well as it fits a Batman.
No, I mean, the thing is that there's an inherent goofiness to superheroes.
Yeah.
And you either run away from it or you embrace it. And when you embrace it, it's better because it's like we're all in on the joke. You know, this is kind of silly, but if you approach it earnestly, if you take the work seriously but not yourself seriously, and you approach it earnestly, obviously you can tell some fantastic stories and still stay in that realm.
Now, do you feel
an example of that is how Marvel? I'm sure there were people at Marvel Productions who wanted to portray Captain America as a goofball, like the Tick, you know, to soften the fact that he's a patriotic hero. But somebody was wise enough to say, no, keep Cap pure, have him double down on that. You know, that's what makes him different. That's what makes him edgy, as ironic as that is. You know, and that succeeded for them wildly.
Yeah, especially in this second film where he's the only pure character in a world of shadows and gray, and he's the only one that survives it, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of it. I mean, the core character is eternal. And, you know, you can't, if you run away from the core, then you're betraying the character, and why bother doing it at all? And plus, it's not going to have the appeal. I mean, these characters have been around for, you know, 70, 75 years for a reason. Mm-hmm.
Now, do you feel the work you've done in the major companies, especially for DC, do you feel that you were able to reflect this, or do you think that your vision was kind of filtered through the company line?
Well, I mean, when I was on Batman, I was on Batman 11 years. The majority of that time, it was under Denny O'Neill,
right,
Scott Peterson, Jordy Orfinkel, and they were hands off.
And Denny's one of the probably the leftiest of all the editors.
He's probably Comic Them's most famous liberal. I mean, yeah. He's famous not only for being an awesome writer, but he's also famous for his political viewpoints because he did put them into, you know, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, some of the most famous pages of Comic-Them, and they're all, this is Denny's liberal philosophy, and Denny's idea of the flawed hero, which I was fine with the idea of the flawed hero, you know, but not the flawed hero who's just an F-up all the time and a creep, and you know, I was like, come on, I mean... I once pointed out to Denny that I had been watching some episodes of Have Gun Will Travel on tape. And I said, I don't know, Denny, but I want to guess that show was a big influence on you. And he just looked at me and he said, yeah, you're right, it was. Because it had this guy who had a bizarre past that shaped who he was. And, you know, he was a tough guy with a mission. And it just seemed so Denny. You know, mm-hmm. but yeah, I mean, and I got along great with Denny. I mean, never a problem. And, right, and we would fight like cats and dogs in politics, but then go right back to work.
Hey, that was the first thing I thought when I read your article was that some of your most influential work was for someone who is so politically different. And you guys obviously had a successful relationship, not being in the room, but the fact that it lasted so long. That again, I thought it's a testament to the sophistication of people to agree to disagree or to not let political fights become emotional, which again, we don't see much of anymore. And that was the most refreshing thing I thought about your article.
I lost you there for a second.
Oh, that's okay. I was just complimenting you.
Oh, okay. Well, we don't need to hear that. but yeah, I mean, there was a lot of mutual respect there. I mean, we really enjoyed working together and enjoyed the sort of the friction, but it was never in the work. I mean, we even did some comics that had not really a political message, but a social message, and we were able to come to common ground on some of that stuff, and you know, and talk it out like adults. But you know, this is before the sort of cliquish nature that took over the business.
When do you think that started to happen?
It's like the day Denny retired. it was like a sea change. It's like, whoa, what? I mean, we gotta put this in the story and that in the story. He's like, well, I'm not comfortable with putting those things in the stories. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. These are for kids. No, we do comics for adults. Yeah, but it's a guy running around in his underwear. It's you know, it's a guy with a magic ring. You know, adults can certainly read them.
Right.
I mean, you can read a Carl Barks Uncle Scrooge story and see all the sophistication and the craftsmanship and just admire the hell out of the art of it. But then you can read it as a kid to just see the, you know, sort of funny, goofy adventure and see what happens next. And that's how I've always approached it. There's you're right for two different levels. You know, it's a straightforward, earnest adventure, but then on another level, it's sort of an arch commentary on human nature or whatever. But never politics, because politics and comics are boring.
Well, yeah, and I agree. I always felt that superheroes really are about the individual. They're not necessarily about the system.
Yeah, and you also – you want to be able to project on your favorite heroes. I mean, Jordan Gorfinkel told me something that when he was a kid and he'd love some superhero, and then on an issue they'd show the superhero going to church on Sunday, and he was always let down because at that point he realized, well, that guy's not Jewish. Hmm. So I can't pretend that he's Jewish like I am. And I really thought about that a lot. And there were a lot of details I would leave out of stories so you could project anything you wanted on the characters. Because, you know, you want to be that guy when you're a kid. And if you start putting the politics in, not only are you going to drive half your audience away, you're going to confuse the other half. And, you're not really not going to make anybody happy in the end. And as I said, it's boring.
Right. So it's really this line you have to walk between making a hero an everyman that you can identify with him, but still differentiating him enough from the other thousands of heroes that exist in his world. Because I mean, we can't go back to the Silver Age where the old Justice League issues, where everybody's basically saying the same dialogue.
Right, right. But I mean, you look at the Marvel, what Stan Lee did, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, these characters had real character. They had real problems. you know, and not necessarily flaws, but they had problems, and they would have a moment of weakness, but overcome it. They would have a difficult decision to make and work around it. And they the Marvel characters seemed, you know, they sort of set the stage for what was to come in comics with, you know, more three-dimensional characters and more relatable characters.
Right. Are there any books do you think coming out of the big two right now that still kind of hold this ideal up, or do you think it's all gone to the specificity in adulthood that they're not accessible anymore?
I just think that the I mean, the book I hear most about out of DC is Batman 66.
Yeah.
Which to me is like, well, shouldn't you do more books like that then? I mean, it's not only all ages accessible, it's all universally accessible.
Yeah, they're doing,
and it's just straight up Batman stories.
Yeah, they're doing a great job with that. I downloaded the first one for my son, and even the way they were handling the iPad was fantastic and eye catching. And then I've been getting it every month. You're right. It's fun, and we don't have a lot of fun in comics anymore.
Well, I mean, like the last big Batman thing that was a big success was Hush. And the reason for it's not hard to see, it had all the classic Batman villains in it, and for all intents and purposes, it was a classic Batman story. And it's like, well, just do more of that, just do more of what your audience is looking for in a Batman story, and the same for every other character. Just do what your readership to a certain extent tells you what they want and what they're looking for. You just have to find a way to, you know, creatively present it fresh, you know, working within that template. And I just think, you know, they got to at least think about that.
Right. So, yeah, because I do think we've lost a lot of the enthusiasm. I just got the Batman World's Finest Archives. And in the introduction of that, they were saying how this was a time when superheroes had fun, where Batman and Superman were always smiling on the cover. And it's
right,
like
right.
And you can say that's goofy and hokey as much as you want, but then there is something of that element, which again is coming through in 66. That I think is lost to a certain extent. I do believe there are some characters that can handle, you know, shades of gray and darkness and better than others. I think there's room for everything. But you know,
yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, you don't want a, you know, a fun loving dead man.
Yeah,
that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, although
But the thing is that what Batman 66 has that it shares with those old comics that were goofy and we can make fun of them because they were somewhat naive, there's an element they had, and it was as silly as the story was and as crazy as the premise was, you had to finish reading it. You know, if Jimmy Olsen showed up for work, you know, as a gorilla, you had to read that story to find out how that happened. And how they were going to resolve it. And the resolution a lot of times was disappointing and a bit of a letdown. But then there was another story right after it, you know, with Lois Lane doing something crazy, and you had to find out how that happened. You know, why is Lois Lane, you know, with a flying trapeze family? And it's like, well, I got to read the story to find out. And they have that what's going to happen next element that I think is missing from a lot of comics.
Right. I was reading this old interview with Carmine Infantino where I'm sure you know this, that he and Julius Schwartz would just pitch covers, and they would have a pile of covers. They go, all right, you figure that out. There's Batman's got a bomb strapped to a gorilla and the gorilla's holding him over his head. All right, give me 16 pages where that happens. And
Nelson Bridwell, I talked to him before he died years and years ago, and he said that Julius Schwartz would just say things like, everybody's afraid to say Captain Marvel's name. And he'd say, well, why would they be afraid to say his name? And he goes, well, I don't get paid to write this stuff. So, you know, they'd have to run off and figure out, well, why are they afraid to say his name?
Yeah, there's a great amount of stories that go off the rails. I was just reading the Bob Haney, Brave and the Bold, and I feel like he would do anything in those pages.
Yes. Yeah, he just, you know, he was a showman. He was just, he wanted you to, you know, he was going to drag you to that next page kicking and screaming. Yeah. You had to find out what happened next. I mean, it was crazy. I remember, you know, that Sergeant Rock story where is it Satan or is it Hitler they're after?
Read that. I got the Jim Aparo hardcover. I just read that, and as we were recording the last episode, I showed it to my co-host, and that panel where he's in the well And he says, "Batman wants to live." And it was like, it reminded me of Krusty trying to jump off the monorail.
But, you know, there's an energy there.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything goes.
Yeah, and you know, that, and that's a quality where if I don't see that in Spider-Man, I quit Spider-Man. Because I feel like that's the one character that absolutely needs that to survive. Like, no matter how dark, like, no matter how sick Aunt May gets, no matter how poor Peter Parker gets, if he's not joking and having fun while fighting supervillains, and there have been eras where they have not done that, the whole bottom drops out of that book.
Yeah, you've got to have that humor, and it's got, and it can't be, you know, placeholder wisecracks. What he says actually has to be funny.
Yeah,
and you know, it's a tough gig, but it's got to be done. And you're right, it's not Spider-Man.
Yeah, and it's interesting how Marvel doesn't seem to be as afraid of it. You see them trying it in ways. I mean, Mark Waid right now is taking Daredevil, who you'd think of as the darkest character. I mean, he was Marvel's Batman for a long time, and he's bringing back that kind of fun and energy to that book, and it's working.
Well, I mean, it's like you know, you can only get so dark, and you got to pull back and start over again. I mean, I think they've gone as far as they can go without just becoming straight porno. So it's like, you know, turning the characters into serial killers and stuff. It's like, you know, you can't, there's only so far you can go down this route until it becomes the law of diminishing returns where, you know, this isn't shocking anymore. You've already shocked us. You know, now we know that you'll do anything. So it's not shocking or anything else. So, you know, Waid's the guy to bring it back to classic form with fun, escape, and swear. It's, you know, intelligently written.
Right. It's almost like horror, where you look at the old Universal horror movies, and they're all about atmosphere, and they're never that terrifying. But then they're topped and topped and topped until you get to like Godzilla and giant ants. And then all of a sudden it's Night of the Living Dead, which is just people banging on a door of a farmhouse, and that's terrifying again.
Right.
It seems like you almost have to push a character as far as they can go until it stops working before you can go back.
But you have to discover a level of craft where you can keep the suspense and everything going without going to the slasher film route or threatening children. It's like what they've done with the Joker. I mean, it's unpleasant, and you don't laugh at him anymore, because even if the jokes are funny, which they should be with the Joker,
right?
It's like, well, I know what's going to happen next. I didn't find Hannibal Lecter knee slappingly funny, so I'm not going to laugh at this either.
Yeah, I always agreed about that with the Joker. There was a period, I think, post Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum, where the Joker just became more and more ghoulish and everything was a dark gallows humor. And I always thought it was way more effective when the Joker was actually really funny, because that let your guard down.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Tony Soprano. I mean, you watch The Sopranos and there are these long periods of time where you're identifying and relating to Tony. And you realize, I like him. You know, he seems like he's a funny guy. He's sophisticated. He's with it. He's this and everything. And then he does like this horrible thing. And you're reminded of who he is.
Right.
And that's really the way the Joker should be. You really shouldn't see it coming each time.
Yeah, and in that way it's almost like Walter White. It was where you spend all this time learning to love him, that when he starts to betray your trust, you don't want to let it go. So even when you get to the end of that series, have you seen all of Breaking Bad?
Yes. You're morally conflicted throughout the whole damn thing. I mean, you know, it's a roller coaster ride, and it really makes you check your own compass over and over again, which that's awesome, right?
Yeah, and that last season, the way he's lit, I mean, he's Dr. Doom by the end of that. But you still kind of root for him because you used to. But that's another thing in your article. You're saying it, not just the grim and grittiness, but kind of the blurring of hero and villain. And I got the impression, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, we've talked a lot about the darkening of heroes, but is there an equal problem in the lightening of villains too much, where if we relate to a villain too much, does he become not a cautionary example?
Yeah, I think every villain it needs some level of sympathy. Like, I can understand what, but I hate what this guy's doing, but I kind of understand what he's doing. I always use an example. There's a moment in the movie Rear Window, Hitchcock classic.
Right.
And they've established that Raymond Burr is a life-killing son of a bitch. And he's got to go. Well, we really don't know the character. We've literally been watching him from a distance through the whole movie. When we see him for the first time, when Jimmy Stewart's helpless, the phone's not working, he's trapped. Mm-hmm. And Raymond Burr comes to kill him. I mean, there's no question he's going to kill this guy who's a witness to the murder. Burr is sort of standing in the darkness, pleading for Jimmy Stewart to back off, you know, like, give me a break, you know. And in that moment, we can't see his face or anything else, but in the voice, he's almost childlike, asking for sympathy. And then he goes and tries to kill Jimmy Stewart. So, but the thing is, it's that much more terrifying and relatable and human, because there's that few seconds where we think, oh, this poor guy is tortured right now. He's trapped, and anybody can identify with that, you know. But we can't identify with what he did before and what he's about to do. But you really do need that. But if you're, you know, if your villain, I don't know, if you're supposed to empathize with him too much, there's a lot wrong with that.
Right.
And then again, if it's like the Joker, the current iteration of the Joker, where he's just a fiend, well, I can't even get into that. I can't see it.
Well, you know, I think the perfect example, you wrote The Punisher for a long time, who is the perfect anti-hero. How did you feel about him? Did you keep a distance where he's partially the villain, or did you lean into he's the hero in a world where this has to be done?
Well, he was the villain in his own book. My biggest regret is that I didn't have like a Lieutenant Gerard character hunting him the whole time. I didn't have him frustrating the law the whole time, you know, to really put forth that this guy's kind of a bad guy, because he's the everyman's darkest side, you know, where, you know, what would I do here if I was the Punisher? I mean, his only saving grace is that he wasn't sadistic. You know, when he ended it for these guys, he ended it quick, and he took mm-hmm. no joy in it. You know, it was just names on a list to him. But yeah, I mean, I pushed the envelope with the Punisher, but it was for that reason. You weren't supposed to admire him as a hero. I mean, right. That's a lot of what we did in Nightfall with Batman. We replaced Bruce Wayne with a guy who was a murdering jerk.
You were talking about Azrael and Batman compared to Punisher, and I kind of wanted to get into the crossover you did between the two.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, as I was saying, you know, a lot of fans thought, you know, why doesn't Batman go lethal, go really dark and start killing off the villains? And we kind of created Azrael and replaced Bruce Wayne with this, you know, homicidal jerk to show people that that wouldn't be a good way to go. It wouldn't make for an appealing character. And so I think we succeeded because sales fell off.
Did they?
Yeah, they really. We were going to make the stunt last a lot longer, but sales started dropping because everybody hated that guy. He was such a jackass.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I was reading it at the time, and as I said in our first call, I was a big fan of the work you and Graham did on that book, and there was a moment where I was like, you know, Bruce Timm has given me Bruce Wayne every day.
There you go.
I came back for Night's End.
Yeah, everybody wants to see him get his ass kicked.
Yeah, but then he was popular enough that his series lasted 100 issues.
Yes, yeah. So they just didn't want to see him as Batman.
Yeah. So comparing Batman and Punisher, you did – there were two crossovers at the time. One was the Azrael Batman, which I think Denny wrote.
But, yes.
But didn't you wrote the sequel that actually had Bruce Wayne and Frank Castle, and that was that was the only time John Romita Jr. drew Batman.
Right.
So how did you delineate the two? Did you think of it as Batman being the hero and Punisher being the villain?
Yeah, absolutely. Punisher was in the way of Batman doing his job. And, you know, Punisher was in a strange city that he wasn't used to. And, you know, doing his usual thing, you know, bull in the china shop approach to everything. Which, of course, that's not Batman. Batman, it's, you know, let's let's do some Sherlock Holmes spade work here before we go in. And to have it, the Joker, you know, the villain who knows Batman next, up against another guy who, for once, the Joker doesn't know what to expect. The Joker psychoanalyzes the two characters and you know, comes to the truth of what motivates them. You know, the difference being that Batman was suffering. He reacts as a child with a mask and boots and cape because his trauma was as a child. Frank Castle reacts lethally because his trauma came as an adult. So the Joker's basically, by the end of the story, has both their numbers.
That's interesting, which would also explain why the Punisher's just in flak gear and no mask, and Batman's dressed like an animal.
Right, right. I mean, you know, Frank Castle's dressed like a soldier.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So, but being involved so much with the terse, dark, more ambiguous Batman, but loving, as you said, the more fun 66, are you still happy with your version of Batman? If you had the chance to go back, would you do more like the 66 version?
Well, you know, Denny O'Neil hated the 66 show. So I have a lot of references in my work to it that I kind of had to hide.
Well, it was his job. It was his job to erase the 66 show from the comics.
Exactly, which he did amazingly well. But the thing is, as I was writing, began to write Batman and Robin as characters, I realized how much of an influence the show had been on me. And thinking back, I mean, the show really did straighten out a lot of continuity problems for Batman and motivation. It provided motivations for the villains that didn't exist for the show that we still use now, even though a lot of creators don't acknowledge it or you know, they just won't admit it to themselves. And, you know, in a lot of cases, the show presented classic versions of these villains and their modus operandi, and I would fall back on a lot of that. And the younger editors in the back crew got every reference, but Denny never did. I mean, there were things like I frequently mentioned the Westward Bridge, which was Adam West, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, and I had a scene in which Batman makes the Batmobile do an instant 180, and Robin just says, you know, you could warn a guy next time. Yeah. So there were little things like that I loved throwing in. And but, you know, it was a big influence on me. So in a lot, I mean, I did a classic Riddler story. I did a classic Joker story with all the tropes. So I'm happy with what I did back then. Yeah, we were a little bit darker, but you know, I didn't go nuts. So to me, they were, these could have been Silver Age stories. They were just a little bit more, you know, mature or sophisticated approach, you know, because that's what the public demanded.
You can find Chuck Dixon's new graphic novel, The Forgotten Man, on Amazon, along with Volume 2 of Bad Times, Blood Red Tide. That's going to do it for Caffeinated Comics this week. Two really interesting conversations, I think. Let us know what you think about it. Leave us a comment on the Caffeinated Comics Facebook page. You'll find links to both Ted Alexander's Kickstarter and Chuck Dixon's article on the Wall Street Journal there. Let us know what you think. The conversation's already kicked off before this episode has even launched. So join in. It'd be great to hear from you guys. If you want to hear from us, you can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. Again, that Facebook page, we're constantly updating, getting more and more members every day. And welcome to all of you. And you can always shop at Chimera's Comics. That's at 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We'll talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that!